Over the past 7 years, as the U.S. has waged wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, President George W. Bush has often invoked his authority as commander-in-chief. It's a fundamental part of the presidency, and it's the focus of this month's Political Projections, our year-long film series in the lead-up to the November elections. The four films we've chosen today as a window into how Hollywood has portrayed the president as commander of our armed forces are Failsafe, 7 Days in May, Air Force One, and 13 Days. And joining me to discuss them are Jeffrey Perrette, whose latest book is called Commander-in-Chief. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And with me in the studio is Robert Sklar, professor of cinema in the Department of Cinema Studies at the Tisch School of the Arts at NYU. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And by the way, to our audience members, if you've watched these movies and want to join in for the conversation, please post any comments you want to make on our show page. Let's begin with you, Jeffrey. Can you take us through the specific responsibilities of the president as commander-in-chief?
Well, the Constitution doesn't spell them out. It simply says the president will be the commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy. But at the time that was the Constitution was written, the commander-in-chief in Britain was, of course, the monarch. And the monarch was expected, if necessary, to lead the army into battle. And then the Battle of Minden in 1753, George II led the British army. But by 1800, that had more or less ceased to be the case. And it was written, though, into the Constitution because nobody doubted that because everybody knew George Washington would be the first president, and nobody doubted that George Washington could lead an army in battle.
So the Founding Fathers did this simply because they were thinking about George Washington.
I'm not sure that they would have given it to anybody else. I mean, Washington, such a towering figure. However, the view that people had then was very elastic. When John Adams was president, he didn't want to lead the army into a battle, and he delegated his commander-in-chief powers to George Washington.
Ah, but since then, I'm sure that every president has wanted those powers. Are there any loopholes or ambiguities that have allowed presidents to interpret this constitutional right in different ways?
Yes, because I think on almost any common sense reading of the Constitution, the Congress is supposed to have most of the power, not the executive branch, and that has been reversed over the last 60 or 70 years.
So
now the president has far more power than Congress.
And does that go back to when Harry Truman invoked his powers as commander-in-chief at the beginning of the Korean War, or is it something that goes back even earlier?
No, he didn't really invoke his powers as commander-in-chief, as far as I can recall. In fact, grabbed hold of the UN flag and wrapped himself in it and said he was doing this in support of the UN. Truman did not ask for a declaration of war because he knew he wouldn't get one.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I mispronounced your name, didn't I? It's Jeffrey Perret.
That's correct.
I will pronounce it correctly from now on. Okay. Robert, let's look at the first film that we are considering, 7 Days in May, which was directed in 1964 by John Frankenheimer. Like Failsafe and 13 Days, it takes place in the early 60s during the height of the Cold War. Do all the films have something in common other than the fact that the Cold War is in the background?
Well, it seems to me that the Cuban Missile Crisis is the central trauma in a way that relates to these films, although if you think of the fact that 7 Days in May was a best-selling novel and Failsafe also was a best-selling novel, that the issues of the films were in the sort of public debate and public mind. Who controlled the nuclear weapons? Could there be a mistake? Could there be a mechanical misfunction? Were there people who were going to be rogue military? So all of those issues played out in the Cuban Missile Crisis, but also prior to and after.
Well, one of these films is actually about the Cuban Missile Crisis. But in this case, 7 days in May, what is the 25 words or less plot summary?
Well, there's a very unpopular president who has signed a nuclear test ban treaty with the Russians, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs has started a coup, or planned a coup, to overthrow the president and take over the government because he finds that peace is a sham and that the government has to remain strong against the Russians.
Jeffrey, do you think, as some suggest, that the character of General James Mattoon Scott is based on Air Force General Curtis LeMay?
Well, John Frankenheimer said that's what it gave him the idea. He had a conversation with LeMay and came away so shaken by it that he felt that people should be warned.
And that's because LeMay actually had thought about overthrowing John F. Kennedy?
No. That's because LeMay was at times seemed to be championing the bit to attack the Soviet Union. And under Eisenhower, he developed a plan that would allow the Strategic Air Command to knock out the Soviet Union and kill about 300 million people. Nevertheless, he devised this plan that if it ever looked like the Russians were about to attack the U.S. would strike first.
Why do you think the movie, I throw this out to both of you, why do you think the movie is set in 1970 and not 1964 when it was made?
Well, it was actually made in 1963, and it was supposed to be released in November of 63. The assassination of John Kennedy changed that, and the movie wasn't released until 64.
The movie doesn't really tell you the date as well as the book does. The date's more or less ambiguous in the movie.
But it's suggesting that the country is moving in a certain direction, and that direction is slightly more totalitarian. This is meant to scare us, isn't it?
Well, you have a president with a 29% approval rating in the film.
I thought you were talking about the current situation. Oh, no, he's 23%.
Yeah, no, in the movie, it's 29%, so he's doing better than George W. Bush.
The other thing is that 7 days in May involves the president signing a test ban treaty. Now, to us, that seems pretty innocuous, but at the time, there were people on the right who portrayed it as some kind of surrender to the Soviet Union.
And it's very unpopular in the film.
Yes, it is. And that provides a premise that says that the people will actually support this coup.
My guests are Jeffrey Perret, P-E-R-R-E-T, author of Commander-in-Chief, just published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and Robert Sklar, professor of cinema at NYU. And we're talking about films that feature the Commander-in-Chief on today's segment of Political Projections. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Robert, in a previous installment in this series, we discussed John Frankenheimer's The Manchurian Candidate. Do you see this film having anything in common with The Manchurian Candidate?
Well, in some ways, of course, although I think Dr. Strangelove is the template for all these films. I mean, they all came out in 1964, Dr. Strangelove in January, 7 days in May in February, and then Failsafe, I think, in maybe October.
And Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove, as we'll get to later, bear a lot of similarities.
It's if Marx said that history repeats itself first as tragedy, then as farce, in this case you have history repeating itself first as farce, then as tragedy.
Columbia produced both Failsafe and 7 days in May, and Dr. Strangelove. And Stanley Kubrick said that this was plagiarism, that Dr. Strangelove was being ripped off, and he was going to sue Columbia for plagiarism if they released his movie after Failsafe. and Columbia backed down, and they released Dr. Strangelove first, and then Failsafe came 7 months later.
We have a clip from 7 days in May where President Lyman confronts General Scott about his plans to stage a military takeover of government.
I am prepared to brand you for what you are, General. A strutting egoist with a Napoleonic power complex and an out-and-out traitor. I know you think I'm a weak sister, General, but when it comes to my oath of office, depending on the Constitution of the United States...
Nobody has to teach me how to salute a flag.
Somebody has to teach you about the democratic processes that that flag represents.
But don't you presume to take on that job, Mr. President, because frankly, you're not qualified. Your course of action in the past year has bordered on criminal negligence. This treaty with the Russians is a violation of any concept of security. You're not a weak sister, Mr. President. You're a criminally weak sister. And if you want to talk about your oath of office, I'm here to tell you face to face, President Lyman, that you violated that oath when you stripped this country of its muscles, when you deliberately played upon the fear and fatigue of the people and told them they could remove that fear by the stroke of a pen. And then when this nation rejected you, lost its faith in you, and began militantly to oppose you, you violated that oath by simply not resigning from office and turning this country over to someone who could represent the people of the United States.
And that would be General James Mattoon Scott, wouldn't it?
Robert, is it important to note who is cast in the role of the president in these films?
It is, and it's very interesting if you think about Kennedy being elected in 1960 and how his young age, and then you have Frederick March in 7 Days in May and Henry Fonda in Failsafe in particular, if we're thinking of those films.
Later Harrison Ford, an action
later
figure.
Later Harrison Ford, yes. The two presidents in the 1964 films are both older men. They're substantial figures, but not, as you say, action figures. They're more father figures, although it's interesting in the four films that we have, those two men aren't represented as fathers. The other two, Harrison Ford and the actor Bruce Greenwood, who plays Kennedy, are fathers. But somehow or other, the image, maybe the Eisenhower image, needs to be resuscitated in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination.
So here we are with Kennedy on everyone's mind, but we have these older presidents. Why not have somebody younger? Is it because they're supposed to have a certain kind of a wisdom that they have acquired with age, going against, in this case, a very strong Burt Lancaster?
Well, in particular, in both films, you have hotheads who are willing to put the country into war. And the question, however unpopular peace may be, some notion of an older man who can be reasonable and keep the nation from going off the deep end seemed to be very important.
We move on to Failsafe. And Jeffrey, we pointed out that there are a lot of similarities between Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove, but one of the major themes of Failsafe is the role that computers play in making important national security decisions. Was there a deep fear in the public that the computers would spin out of control? We'd seen something like that in 2001, which ironically was made by Stanley Kubrick.
Well, yes, but to my mind, this is the most pessimistic of the four movies, because the mechanical systems that are supposed to protect the country break down. And so then the default setting is the human beings, the president, his advisors, the military, and they can't stop this disaster either. So there are two layers of supposedly command and control here, and both of them have failed. And I think that was exactly, that addressed directly the kind of fear that some people felt after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And what does Failsafe refer to? Failsafe is when the warplanes get to a point where you can't recall them.
So one bomber gets through the Soviet air defenses and puts a 25 megaton nuclear bomb on Moscow. Now, I don't know that there was such a thing then. I think the biggest up until then had been a 10 megaton test that the Russians had run. It created so much radioactivity around the world, the Russians stopped doing that. Nevertheless, a bomb of that size would have certainly wiped out virtually everybody in Moscow. I'm not sure that Henry Fonda, as the president, made a decision that the military would have accepted.
Part of the movie takes place, Robert, in a boardroom where U.S. generals and a political science professor played by Walter Matthau discuss the nature of war. What was the logic of the war machine during the Cold War?
Well, in the film, the Walter Matthau character seems to be based on Herman Kahn or Henry Kissinger in some terms of Herman Kahn, the advocate of, or at least thinking about the unthinkable, could we survive thermonuclear war? How many millions of dead could the country suffer and still
survive?
He
had published a book along those lines about 5 or 6 years earlier, so it was not implausible. But did the American public feel that nuclear conflict between the U.S. and the USSR was just a couple of clicks away?
It's interesting. I mean, my personal memory of being a graduate student in 1962 and following the news of the Cuban Missile Crisis was thinking, I'd like to finish this term paper before the world ends. but I think anyone who was alive in those days would remember how close we came to or feel how close we came to nuclear war.
We have to take a little break, but we'll go out with a clip from this movie, Failsafe, where the president, played by Henry Fonda, orders American personnel to assist the Soviets in stopping. Oh, we're not going to play the clip. Okay, we'll come back with that clip. My guests are Robert Sklar, who is professor of cinema at NYU, and Jeffrey Perret, who's author of Commander-in-Chief, which is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux.
Gentlemen, this is the President of the United States. Whatever orders I give to American personnel are to be considered direct orders from the Commander-in-Chief. They are to be obeyed fully, without reservation, and at once. We must do everything we can to prevent our planes from attacking Moscow. The Soviet premier has behaved as I believe I would under similar conditions. He has delayed retaliation. I think he believes this is an accident. But we must convince him and his chief advisors that it is. I therefore order every American to cooperate fully with Soviet officers in shooting down our invading planes.
The president didn't consult with the generals. He made the decision to resolve this conflict in a way that would upset people like me, a New Yorker. But he did it on his own. Would that be possible under the Constitution, Jeffrey?
Well, yeah. The other thing is he's prepared to make a sacrifice. His wife is in New York. The First Lady is going to go along with everybody else,
including me. I would have been there.
I'm afraid so. I just have my doubts that made any sense at all. It was dramatic, though. I'll admit that. I remember when I saw the movie, my mouth fell open. But if they've wiped out Moscow, who are they going to talk to? The Soviet leadership will, by and large, be gone. And just making contact with people in Russia would probably be very hard. I think the telephone system would have just fried. There would have been so much radioactivity around; it'd be almost impossible for people to move. So I think it's a fanciful, shall we say, it's a poetic ending. It certainly doesn't hold up to scrutiny.
Robert, how was the movie received?
I think it was received positively. I think all these films were. They were taken seriously by the public at the time. It seems to me, I've mentioned Strangelove earlier, that was the film that for my generation really made all the difference, in the sense that it held up all these serious ideas to ridicule, and sort of the final joke at the end where the world blows up, and it shook us out of a willingness to accept the government's pronouncements without a grain of salt.
And it was much more of a success than 7 Days in May. I mean, than Failsafe.
It was a bigger success, but if people have studied the box office, it was a success in metropolitan areas, the East Coast, the West Coast. It was not a success in the middle of the country, and probably Failsafe was more popular with the general movie-going audience.
Now, the next movie wasn't a big hit, 13 Days, directed by Roger Donaldson, released in 2000. Why do you think they were revisiting the Cuban Missile Crisis in 2000?
Well, if we think of both these films of the late 20th century, including Air Force One, there were new issues, in a sense, about the president and the capacity to act. I'm switching your question, but around Air Force One, the situation in ex-Yugoslavia and Bosnia and so on was extremely frustrating, and the idea of, can the president act? How can the president act? Was a bigger issue in the late 1990s, perhaps even in the 1960s.
In fact, in Air Force One, Saddam Hussein's name comes up, gets a snicker from an audience today. Well, Jeffrey, what do you think was going on there? One of the interesting aspects of the film is that it really focuses as much on Kevin Costner's character, Kenneth O'Donnell, as it does on Kennedy. Kenneth O'Connell is the president's special political advisor. He's our window into the events, but he also gives us a sense that decisions on foreign policy have to be filtered through the political implications.
Well, I have to tell you, as the author of a biography of John Kennedy, I absolutely loathe that film.
Even though Kennedy comes across as rather heroic.
Yes, he does. But Kenneth O'Donnell was a liar and a crook.
You mean the real Kenneth O'Donnell was?
The real Kenneth O'Donnell. And
but I hope he had a better accent, a better Boston accent than Kevin Costner does in the movie.
Well, that is something for him to work on. But Kenneth O'Donnell presents himself as being a central figure, really more or less on a par with JFK. When the tapes on which this script is supposedly based do not show that at all. Kenneth O'Donnell dealt with people on the Hill. He also raised money for John Kennedy, the money went into O'Donnell's account, and he took 50%, and then the other 50% was passed on to the campaign. So to see somebody who I know to be a crook being presented in this heroic light is more than I can stand.
But okay, but getting to the gist of this story, do you think that JFK did an exemplary job as commander-in-chief during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
He did. I think presidents are remembered for two things at most. And you get 1,000 other problems resolved, but there are going to be some really big ones, probably just two or three in the course of an administration, and you have to get those two right. It doesn't matter. Then if you get all these lesser decisions wrong, as long as you get the two big ones right. And Kennedy got his two big ones right. He, by and large, found a way through that crisis using his own will and his own imagination. He was the guy who pulled it off. He deserves virtually all of the credit for that.
Now, Robert, do you think that it works as a movie?
Well, we might point out that of the four films, it's the only one that if you stay to the end and watch all the credits, you see at the very end of the credits a small acknowledgement to a book edited by a historian, Ernest May and another historian called the Kennedy Tapes. And so all these conversations, as in the Johnson administration and the Nixon administration and so on, presumably secretly taped and then became part of the archive. It has a kind of veneer of authenticity, but it seems to me it's as much a fantasy as the other three films.
We have a clip from the movie where President Kennedy, played by Bruce Greenwood, reprimands General Maxwell Taylor, head of the Joint Chiefs, for making an important order without his approval.
Kenny, you hear me give the order to go to DEFCON 2? Because I remember giving the order to go to DEFCON 3, but I must be suffering from amnesia. Just been informed our nuclear forces are at DEFCON 2.
They were limited. Mr. President, the orders were limited to our strategic forces
Max.
In the continental United States. General LeMay is correct. Technically, SAC has the statutory authority.
I have the authority. I am the Commander-in-Chief of the United States, and I say when we go to war.
We're not at war, sir. Not until DEFCON 1.
General. The Joint Chiefs have just signaled our intent to escalate to the Soviets. You signaled an escalation which I had no wish to signal and which I did not approve.
So, Jeffrey, does the Joint Chief of Staff report directly to the President, or does he report to the Secretary of Defense?
All right. When the JCS was set up, it was expected that the chairman would report directly to the President, speaking on behalf of the other chiefs, and would be the president's principal military advisor. But John Kennedy despised all of the chiefs except for one, the Marine Commandant, David Chu. And the chiefs under John Kennedy were reduced to not just pygmy status, but they couldn't speak either. And I think there was a lot of resentment about that. I think some of the pushing that came from LeMay was born out of his resentment at seeing the chiefs reduced really to nodding donkeys. And LeMay is essentially the focus of this. The Air Force felt that it had the primary responsibility of stopping the Soviet nuclear attack on the U.S., and so LeMay, of course, took the lead in these discussions because those Soviet missiles would have been able to make a first strike against any number of SAC bases on such short notice that SAC's plan to strike first would be vitiated.
We should move on to the last film, which is Air Force One, which was released in 1997. Robert, can you give us a plot summary? And do you think that this president, but played by Harrison Ford, is a Democrat or a Republican?
That's a good question. Well, he's a Vietnam veteran. He holds the Congressional Medal of Honor. He certainly didn't dodge the draft like several of our recent presidents. But in the film, there has been a joint Russian-American raid on Kazakhstan to capture and remove a general who it seems to be ready to restore communism and Mother Russia and so forth. And some of the adherents of this general work their way onto Air Force One and then start shooting up the plane and then the president becomes the superhero who saves the day.
We have a clip from the movie where the Secretary of Defense and the Vice President request the Attorney General's advice on what the Constitution prescribes in a situation where the president is in danger, may even be dead at this point because nobody is sure just what's going on with the president on this plane.
Madam Vice President,
Attorney General.
Thank you for coming, Andrew.
Hello, Catherine.
Yes.
Welcome. Good that you're here. I'm told that you want my interpretation as to what the Constitution says about this situation.
Yes. Now, Andrew, my understanding is that if the president is out of contact in a military situation, the Secretary of Defense is in charge as second in command.
Yes, of course.
Good. Then that settles it.
It doesn't settle it at all. The president is not merely out of contact. He is also under duress. His family is held hostage. possibly himself a hostage. It creates an incapacity to discharge the office under the 25th Amendment. Surely just as if he'd had a stroke.
I think the president would dispute that any incapacity exists.
It exists if a majority of the cabinet, including yourself, says it exists. The president may be alive, but he may not be the president.
Jeffrey, how accurate is the constitutional interpretation we have been listening to?
Well, the president's powers as commander-in-chief have grown so expansive that I have a feeling that that document would not be would not be enough. And incidentally, it should have 16 signatures on it. But if you freeze frame the film, you can see there are only two.
Well, the idea of having Glenn Close automatically moving into the Oval Office is kind of attractive, isn't it?
Well, it is. And one day it will no doubt happen. But can I make a general point about these presidential movies? That the war film seems to be becoming a major influence in movies about presidents, especially when the presidents, as happens in Air Force One, are going to unleash redemptive violence, and that, I'm afraid, has become all too real.
Well, in this case, the president is an action figure. He fights better than any of these much younger men. Harrison Ford just seems to be the equivalent of a killing machine. You would think that he would have gone on to become governor of California or something rather than to have been president of the United States.
Quite so, but this does go back to something that is important in not just Western cultures, but most. And that is the warrior king. There is a yearning for the warrior king that runs through much of our culture and other people's as well. And Air Force One taps directly into that.
What do you think a movie featuring President Bush as commander-in-chief would depict? Has the war on terror expanded his authority as commander-in-chief?
Well, that movie's already been made. It's Harold and Kumar escape from Guantanamo Bay.
Do you agree, Robert?
Well, it strikes me that one of the generalizations one can make about all four of these films is once you take the lid off the administration, there are rivalries, there are insubordination, there are coups, there are plots, you get a sense of an American government that is not very well together. And maybe in the George Bush administration, they maintained discipline a little better than the presidents in these movies.
But it's interesting that in all four, we have the buck stops here at the commander-in-chief's desk. In effect, even in the case of Air Force One, there's no desk. Well, there is a desk on the plane, but you know what I mean. He is the final protector of all of our liberties in these movies. Are these movies meant to reassure us that that we choose wisely when we choose our presidents?
I think what it means is that people in democracies like to believe that it's democracy gets them through the hard times. But when the hard times really come, people want a savior.
Thank you both so much for being with us. Jeffrey Perret, author of Commander-in-Chief, and Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and Robert Sklar, professor of cinema at New York University.